Well, good morning. I hereby call to order the Palm Beach Transportation Planning Agency meeting. Today's Thursday, March 15th, 2018, and the time is 9:14. And our first order of business is roll call.
Stephen Abrams.
Here.
Mary Lou Berger.
Here.
Joni Brinkman.
Here.
Paulette Burdick.
Here.
Joelle Flores. Ann Gerwig.
Here.
Carrie Glickstein. Stephen Grant.
Here.
Susan Hazing.
Here.
Lynn Hubbard. Keith James is excused. Jim Koretsky is excused. Maria Marino.
Here.
Melissa McKinley. Fred Pinto.
Here.
Paula Ryan. Pam Triolo is excused. Hal Valache.
Here.
Catherine Waldron.
Here.
Robert Reinroth is excused. Steve Wilson.
Here.
We have a forum, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Mayor Wilson is going to lead us in the prayer and the pledge. If you'll please rise.
Thank you. We're going to send a special prayer to our good friend, Commissioner Abrams. Let's all bow our heads, please. Oh, Heavenly Father, we come to you once again with bowed heads and humble hearts, yet thanking you for another day. Father, today we pray for the people who are facing desperate and lonely times. We pray especially for our children, the teachers, the staff, and the defenseless ways of manning in school. Keep them in your prayer, Lord. Help us to meet their needs with each and every day. Give us a spirit of caring and kind hearts towards each other, realizing you've been better to us than we've been to ourselves. And with that, we say thank you. And finally, Father, we say unto you, bless us and make us in ways that you will always have with the love and care for mankind. Give us your strength to walk through this day with each other in a most loving and humble way, realizing that in this room alone, there are no strangers. Just friends we have not yet met. We give you all the praise and the glory. Amen.
Amen. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Great, and thank you so much. And if this time I was going to ask Mayor McKinley to give us a welcome to her district. If she comes back with a coffee, beautiful area. This is a beautiful facility. And we're very grateful to the County Library System for hosting us this morning.
My apologies, my son arrived home for spring break at 3 o'clock in the morning last night with two of his buddies. So I need a little extra juice this morning. I'm a little disappointed that nobody from West Palm Beach is here today to see the importance of why we need State Road 7 extended out this way. But anyhow, welcome to the acreage. If you came up the Southern Boulevard way, you drove through the new city of Westlake, and I don't think you can miss it with those monstrosity of signs that they have, but a lot going on out here, and the county has, and my fellow commissioners have been wonderfully supportive in trying to do as much as we can to alleviate the traffic concerns in this part of the district. I'd like to thank Mayor Wilson for being here. I know we were supposed to be out in Belgrade this morning, and Nick had to make a last-minute change, so thank you for at least keeping it in the district. And with that, Madam Chair, I just welcome everybody to the lovely part of the county that is the acreage, and let's get this meeting underway.
Great. Thank you so much. It is beautiful out here. Our next item is our agenda. Are there any changes now?
No, Madam Chair.
Seeing none, I'll entertain a motion to adopt.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, motion by Pinto, second by Berger. Any further discussion? All those in favor state so by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed. Minutes. We have the minutes of February 15th, 2018. Are there any corrections or additions? Seeing none, I'll entertain a motion. Motion by Burdick, second by McKinley. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor state so by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed. Great. Now we're going to move to our special presentation, and it is Florida Bicycle Month. And we have our own special proclamation. At the conclusion of our meeting, we're all going to take a group picture out in the parking lot. We thought it would be important to include the whole board. Declaring March 2018 as Florida Bicycle Month, whereas the state of Florida and Florida Bicycle Association recognizes March officially as Florida Bicycle Month, and the Palm Beach Transportation Planning Agency will recognize it locally, and whereas the Palm Beach TPA and its Bicycle Trailways and Pedestrian Advisory Committee encourage active mobility as well as bicycle infrastructure that improves safety for citizens through both the planning and programming of bicycle facilities throughout the county, and whereas the Palm Beach TPA has set a target of zero bicycle-related fatalities and injuries, and whereas the Palm Beach TPA will work with Palm Beach County, PalmTrans, and the Florida Department of Transportation and various other organizations and local municipalities to encourage bicycling as an alternative form of transportation and fund infrastructure projects for non-motorized users. And whereas through these partnerships, Palm Beach County now has over 170 miles of designated bicycle lanes, 90 miles of paved shared use pathways, and more than 600 additional miles planned, and will continue to promote its connected network of improved bicycle level of service. Now, therefore, be it proclaimed by the Governing Board of the Palm Beach Transportation Planning Agency, assembled in regular session this 15th day of March, 2018, that the month of March, 2018, in Palm Beach County is hereby proclaimed Florida Bicycle Month. Be it further proclaimed by the Governing Board of the Palm Beach Transportation Planning Agency, that this proclamation is duly sealed, written, executed by the chair and vice chair of this board. So everyone that we have t-shirts, and everyone in every jurisdiction that participated in some type of Bicycle Month activities, and I'm sure that Valerie's going to share with us all those wonderful things. And at the conclusion of this meeting, we are going to take that group picture. So Valerie, if you can share with us some of the things happening in our county this month.
Thank you, Mayor Haney. Yes, so happy Florida Bike Month. We know of six proclamations in our county that have joined the state in celebrating bicycling during the month of March, because it's a beautiful time of year to be outside today. So we have the City of Boca Raton, the City of Green Acres, which I think it was their first time doing a Florida Bike Month proclamation, City of West Palm Beach, the county did it this week, we're doing it today, and then also the Village of Palm Springs. So we want to congratulate all our cities who joined in this and celebrating bicycling as an alternative mode of transportation, promote health, and to promote sustainability and multimodal transportation. We have our website, bikepalmbeachtart.org, has a bunch of events going on this month. If you know of any others that are not on there, please add them onto the calendar. This week is Bike to Work Week in the City of West Palm Beach, so there's been a lot of events going on this week, and tomorrow we're joining them for a Bike to Work Day ride from Magnolia Park Tri-Rail Station to City Hall. We're inviting all of you to join us and wear your bright, visible Bike Palm Beach shirts that you got today. If you need a bike, we Sky Bike has offered to provide bikes for those who need one. Please bring your helmet to be safe, but it's going to be a great event. For sure, Hal Valachay is going to lead it again this year, and we hope to see more of our board members join us in this group ride to celebrate biking. So if you have any questions, please let me know, and we hope you'll stay for our group picture at the end of the
day. Thank you, Valerie. Mary
Kimmel. Just a comment, Valerie. Thank you for everything that you're doing, and if I didn't have a meeting at 10 a.m. in Okeechobee tomorrow, I would ride bike to work. But you know, when we do these in the future, what would be helpful is, I know we can't solicit, but we could certainly encourage or get some sort of listing of the bike shops around town. As you can see, being out this far, I don't think there's any way somebody would ride their bike to the county building downtown if they lived here in the acreage. But if we had some sort of partnership with some of the sporting goods stores for bike racks, maybe that would, at least when they're downtown, they could not drive their car if they go to lunch or need to run errands, they could ride their bike when they're downtown. Maybe try to encourage that kind of message in the future for the folks that live out this way.
Yeah, thanks. We actually learned yesterday at our workshop, we had a young lady who's an engineer at the City of West Palm Beach. She lives in Loxahatchee, and she's biked to work from out here a few times. She said it was a very rough experience, which has made her more passionate about trying to create better facilities because she'd like to bike to work, but it was like a 30-mile bike ride. And they also have another lady in their sustainability office who bikes from Jupiter to downtown once a week. So, but yes, we need to improve and make it, reach out to, make it better for everyone to bike. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Valerie, maybe you could look into, I wrote an article yesterday about a new bike sharing concept that's being tried in San Francisco, where instead of having a central location where you pick up and drop off the bikes, you can just drop them off anywhere, and it's tracked by GPS. You walk the bike through an app, and you know, you sign up and you get a code to unlock it, ride it wherever you want. So, you know, it's absolutely door-to-door. You could maybe just look into that and give us a short presentation at some point. I thought it was a very interesting concept, which I think will increase the use of bike sharing, because it's much more convenient.
Yeah, as a Lime Bike, they do that.
Yeah.
It's Lime Bike, that it makes presentations to us.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of pros and cons, like some controversy going on with that, with the dockless biking. And I know, like in Miami, they got Lime Bike, but then they also had City Bike, which has actual stations, and the Lime Bikes were being left on the beach. And so we plan to do we want to do a bike share study for the entire county, because we want it to be interoperable. We want people to be able to bike from one city to the other and really evaluate all the different options and what would be best. But I know that that's something that people are debating on.
That was a big battle we had in the last few days of session. Those bike sharing companies were trying to preempt local governments from enacting any ordinances about where we could deposit those bikes when they're done with them. If you look at some of the, I don't believe it's in the U.S., but some of the European countries that have this, it has led to all sorts of problems with bikes just being left on sidewalks, being left in right-of-ways. So I would caution that we tread very, very carefully moving forward with that type of concept and push back on any attempts of the legislature to preempt us on it.
Good point. And you know, it's wonderful that the TPA wants to have a regional solution, because we're working with Skybike in Boca Raton now between FAU and the city. I know West Palm uses Skybike. It would be wonderful if we could, you know, somehow have more of a regional solution. I don't know, is anybody else looking at any of these bike share programs in their community? No? Delray, Boca, and I know it's promised. So, but we have had Lime Bike give a presentation, but we want to have something jointly with Florida Atlantic University, which makes sense. So.
Okay,
great. Well, thanks for all you do, Valerie. We did our bike ride the other morning, and it was wonderful. So.
Yeah, thank you.
Several communities. Over the past weekend.
Yeah, we had some great slides of all the fun things that everybody did. So we will now move to comments from the chair and and any members. My only comment is that I'm very grateful that I was reelected as chair of the Southeast Florida Transportation Council once again. So that's the regional MPO for Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm. We do all those regional plans. So great group and a good. A good observation. We are observed in Palm Springs for doing such a great job, and Nick really works collaboratively with the other MPO directors and best practices in Southeast Florida. Mm-hmm.
Very good. Congratulations.
Thank you. Any member, other member comments here? We want to welcome Mayor Pinto. Congratulations on your re-election.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. Does anybody else survive Tuesday?
They're not here.
Any other member comments on any transportation? Seeing none, we'll move to the director of this report.
Nope. Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I do want to wish Mayor Wilson a happy birthday. We are pleased to have him here on his birthday this morning.
Oh, bless you.
And then I did want to mention, in honor of his birthday, we do have donuts from Jupiter Donuts in Royal Palm Beach, so we're glad to support a local business in Palm Beach County, and they are very good. If you haven't tried one, do it in honor of Mayor Wilson. And then I did want to mention, if you travel here this morning from the north, I know from the south you actually got to travel through the city of Westlake. If you came through from the north on Northlake Boulevard, you actually passed by the future community of Avenir, which is in Palm Beach Gardens. That will be on the north side of Northlake, so as you were driving along, You may not have noticed, but you were adjacent to where those 3,200 homes and the additional non-residential development in that project are going to be located. Running through the items in my report, first, we did have the deadline for applications to our TPA funding programs occur at the beginning of the month. We received 11 local initiative applications requesting a total of $32 million in funding, and 8 transportation alternative applications requesting a total of $6 million in funding. We have highlighted just the list of jurisdictions that submitted projects, as well as the location and a brief summary of the projects that were submitted on the rear side of the report. A very important topic for our communities right now is the status of Brightline supplemental safety measure construction. So the additional gates that we have funded and a reimbursement agreement with Brightline are going in right now. They're actually under construction this week in West Palm Beach. I was on the corridor yesterday morning and taking some pictures and watching the crews work. They are installing those gates to provide a continuous barrier across the entrance to the rail corridor at our busiest 34 crossings in Palm Beach County. They're not installing those exit gates at all of the crossings, but they're installing them at the busiest crossings in order to mitigate the risk associated with taking away a train horn and allowing all of our communities to file the notices of establishment necessary to create quiet zones should they choose to do so. I am asking that you please engage your public outreach staff and your public outreach channels. If your city chooses to move forward with a quiet zone designation, just reinforcing the message that we have to respect the gates. When the gates are down, it is very important to stay off the track. As a vehicle, as a pedestrian, as a bicyclist, don't drive around them, don't go under them, don't enter the tracks when the gates are down. That means the train is approaching, and we really need your help to reinforce that safety message throughout our community. Quick item here on the legislative summary. The House Bill 33, which I had mentioned last month, sought to make texting while driving a primary offense, did not pass the legislative session. So it's not texting is still not a primary offense. There's a lot of reasons for that. But we are hopeful to be able to move forward with that type of legislation or support that type of legislation. It's one of the statewide MPO, AC, MPO Advisory Council priorities to see Florida move in that direction to make distracted driving a less common occurrence on our roadways. Also want to mention there were several bills as well as amendments to existing other bills which sought to make changes to the laws regulating how many members can serve on an MPO governing board, but none of them passed. So I just wanted you to know that there were people who thought it might be a good idea to reduce the number of board members that you could have serving on an MPO. But those legislative activities were not successful this session. Something just to highlight briefly is part of Florida Bike Month, some bike lane activity in Palm Beach County. One of our priorities in our long-range plan is to add more miles of what we call buffered bike lanes, or bike lanes that are separated from the vehicular travel lane by at least a couple of stripes and more distance, so that it's clear that cars are supposed to drive to the left, bicycles are given priority space to the right, and nary the twain shall meet. Two of those projects are on the State Road 7 corridor, one just recently completed north of Clintmore Road to Atlantic Avenue, which added 2.5 miles of buffered bike lanes in that part of Palm Beach County. And then also the section from Broward County north to Glades Road is under construction right now, and that corridor will provide an additional 2.8 miles of buffered bike lanes. And then in celebration of Florida Bike Month, and because St. Patrick's Day is on Saturday, I wore a green tie, because Palm Beach County just this week received their interim approval to begin marking bicycle facilities with green paint. We are excited to see the county take the initiative and establish that approval. Several of our cities have already done that. The Florida DOT has already done that. Now Palm Beach County has the option. They're not committing to paint every bike lane everywhere green, but they have the option of painting at least the high conflict areas where vehicles that want to turn right have to cross a bicycle lane. We can paint those areas green in order to highlight the conflict and promote visibility for the cyclists at those points on our roadway. We're really excited to say that. And then I've also listed here all the board representatives and alternates that were reelected in Tuesday's municipal election. So congratulations to each of you. So it's my understanding, now that's a city-initiated project. The TPA is not involved in the funding of that or the implementation of it. So it's my understanding from the city staff. Yeah, so you ask me, I try to find out anything I can about transportation. I like to know that the city is doing a more thorough evaluation of the impact of narrowing the median and what that will have on the existing trees in the median before they go forward with that project. So part of the project was to introduce what are called separated bike lanes, a full physical barrier between the car and the bicycle along the corridor. But in order to do that on Cumberland Drive within the existing width of the right-of-way, the median had to be narrowed. And so as you had noted, that would have potentially had adverse effects on the trees within the median, and so they're doing a more detailed study before they proceed with the project. I don't think it's been fully scrapped, but they're not moving forward until they know they can do so without harming them.
Mayor Marino.
Nick, yesterday at our discussion, is there a procedure for cities to talk to the county about how to get bike lanes painted within their city?
That's a good question. I will note, and I neglected to say this, I should have mentioned this in my report, that everywhere where the county is milling and resurfacing a road as part of their infrastructure surtax project list, they have committed to providing 11-foot travel lanes for vehicles, and where they are able to provide a designated 4 or 5 foot bicycle facility adjacent to those vehicle lanes. The question would come up then, how can we encourage them to paint those lanes green in particular areas? What I'd like to suggest, and this, we're gonna talk a little bit more about this in the summary of the workshop, as item, I wanna say 3A on your agenda. But what I'd like to suggest is that we will commit to making sure you know where those projects are going to occur and when within your jurisdiction, so that you have ample opportunity to request that kind of investment of a few extra dollars to promote visibility for cyclists when those projects happen. On existing corridors, the question is a little trickier, frankly, because in most places, Palm Beach County has not designated bike lanes on their existing roadways. They're committing to do that going forward, but they're not going back and doing it to roads they're not touching for some other reason. So we just want to make sure you're aware of opportunities as they come up, and we ask them to do as much good as they can over there.
But since Federal Highway approved the county for doing that, does that mean blankets throughout the cities can be paint our bike lanes green?
It's my understanding that every jurisdiction that has that wants to do that on city roads needs to have their own letter requesting that permission. I do know that Boca Raton has that letter.
Yes.
It has
well, I know, but I just want to share that with all the other cities.
Yeah, as well as Delray Beach and West Palm Beach, but I'm not sure that other municipalities have taken that approach yet.
Okay, well, maybe we can give a sample letter to the other cities so that they can ask for the same.
That would be great.
Commissioner Berta.
There is someone from County Engineering. I don't think I saw David come in, but Mo Alturk from the County's Traffic Division, who oversees their striping decision for their county roads, is actually here this morning.
Good morning, Mo. I would just ask, I know that I've spoken before with regard to the striping and the painting. The ongoing concern is the ongoing maintenance of keeping it up. Within declining gas tax revenue, so if cities want to participate, maybe the county look at doing it first, and then the ongoing upkeep for the paving between the cities. So, I don't know how long does that green paint last.
We don't have experience with that, obviously. So that tell you how many things. I know that it's a maintenance burden, and I know that many of the jurisdictions that have put it in place, including this Palm Beach, which is one of the areas out there that have been they put an extensive link of green, and now they regret it because obviously it's going to cost them a lot of money.
We can't
even
keep up with lane striping. Yeah. Have a physical kind of that. Thank you.
Yeah, I think Nick, alluded to that we would like to see maybe on the areas where there is conflict, to highlight those conflict areas where cars can cross, whatever, like it might be, or vice versa. And that's something probably the county can consider. That's one of the things that we can.
Great.
Mayor
McKinley.
I'm just wondering if Nick, if you had any conversations with the Water Utilities Department, when they started particularly out in the glades where they're tearing up the roads and replacing water lines all the time, part of their contract, which doesn't fall under engineering, it falls under water utilities, is to repair those roads. So at that time, they might be able to upgrade those roads. So you might want to reach out to Jim Stiles and have a conversation with him.
I'll do that.
Great idea. Yeah, Berwick.
Well, first, I would like to give a shout out to Nick for riding his bike, because I actually was glancing at my cell phone at a stoplight when Nick came flying by. So I do know that he's out there and he's watching you. So and eye contact and looking at my cell phone in my hand. Anyway. I also want to give a shout out to my alternate on this board, Councilman Napoleone. He met with one of our local triathletes and talked with him about, he was unhappy with our continuous bike lane issues in Wellington. And in the off season in Wellington, when there's not very many people in the Western Preserve area, those roads are really a great opportunity for long distance bike riders. Now, whether it's transportation or recreation, it's bike riding. And I'm assuming Nick wasn't working because he was wearing a spandex that day. So. But even yet, we're looking at that in Wellington. And with limited right-of-way, when your right-of-way is used for drainage and swale purposes, you don't have the ability to add 11 feet on two sides in a lot of places. So we're looking at working towards shared roads on those equestrian preserve area roads that aren't, don't get much use in the off season. But we're working with the local community, and I wanted to give Councilman Napoleone a shout out for having that meeting and reporting it, and that information's available if anyone's interested how they looked at it. They did agree that an 11-foot dedicated bike lane on one side of the road would be something that we would probably have to do. We couldn't do it on both. It's just not even possible. So as we look at milling and replacing, we're going to be keeping that in mind.
Excellent. Thanks. Any further comments or questions on the executive director's report? Seeing none, thanks, Mayor. The only thing that's missing is happening in February is we cut the ribbon on the Spanish River FAU interchange. And part of that included a tunnel under Yamato Road to connect the El Rio Trail. And we're working with Del Rey to extend that to be a more of a regional facility. So that'll be pretty exciting stuff. So.
Sure, and Madam Chair, just for clarification, what I've done on the director's report is only to provide a summary. It's a summary of the minutes, if you will, of what happened at our last.
Oh, board what meeting. You did. Okay.
What happened at what this governing board did at their last meeting. In case you didn't have a chance to attend, and you want to briefly see what occurred in your absence.
Okay. Well, then it's our job to bring up those other things.
Yeah, please do so.
Okay, thank you. I will now move to the consent agenda. Is there any member that wishes to remove any item from the consent agenda? Seeing none, I'll entertain a motion. Motion by McKinley, second by Burdick to approve the consent agenda as presented. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor state so by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed. This is the time in our meeting when we invite any member of the public to come forward and provide any general public comment. Anyone present who would like to address the board on any matter? Nope. Seeing no one come forward, we will now move to our action items. And our first item is the Transportation Disadvantaged Local Coordinating Board Chairman appointment. Nick.
Madam Chair, briefly, the Transportation Disadvantaged Local Coordinating Board, their job is to identify local service needs for paratransit service that will be funded through a state transportation disadvantage grant to home care. So they're trying to make sure that those dollars, which is around $2.8 to $3 million per year, are used as effectively as possible to provide that service. It is a board comprised of appointees from various entities in Palm Beach County, but it is intended by statute to be chaired by a local elected official. Currently, Councilmember Robert Weinroth has served as the chair. He's been the chair for 1 year, but he asked to step down from that position, and we are seeking a nomination for someone who's willing to serve as the chair of that board. I do want to mention that the board does meet quarterly, the second month of each quarter. So what that means is it meets February, May, August, and November. Those meetings are in the afternoon, and our next meeting is on May 30th at 2 p.m.
Anyone want to volunteer, or do you know a colleague that you would like to volunteer?
So I remember last year I requested also, and there was a vote, correct?
Yes.
So I'll be happy to step up again.
Wonderful, Mayor.
I move to appoint Mayor Grant.
Second.
He's never been this popular.
We have a motion by Commissioner Abrams and a second by Mayor McKinley to appoint Mayor Stephen Grant. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor state so by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, congratulations, and thank you for stepping up. We appreciate that. That's awesome. All right, we'll now move to our next item, which is our TPA budget. Nick.
So, Madam Chair, this item is a little bit out of sequence on our agenda because we're really going to go into more detail in what we hope to accomplish in the coming 2 years in item 3B in our federally required budget, which is called the Unified Planning Work Program. But because our interlocal agreement with Palm Beach County requires us to transmit our budget request on their schedule, not on our federal schedule, we need to do this item this morning. So I'm asking for your approval to transmit the fiscal year 19 budget request to Palm Beach County. And I want you to understand that this request does include three key components to it. First, we're asking for, in anticipation of the full transition to an independent agency over some point during this coming fiscal year, which is beginning October 1 of this year from a county perspective, so it's October 1 of 18 through September 30th of 19, we have included the additional funding needed to accommodate one-time moving costs to allow us to relocate to a private office space. We've also included an estimated amount of additional funding needed to accommodate increased lease expenses associated with that private office space. So those are the first two items. The third component of this request is to add two staff positions to the agency. And let me explain those two requests briefly to you. First, there's a great deal of interest in expansion of transit services in Palm Beach County. And so we're asking for the creation of a lead planner position to focus attention on those transit initiatives that we are currently trying to move forward, such as the extension of Tri-Rail service into northern Palm Beach County, the improvement of transit service on the US 1 corridor, and our upcoming Okeechobee Boulevard multimodal corridor that's going to try to recommend investment and improve transit service in an east-west capacity. So we really think that's a key position that will allow us to better collaborate with PalmTran as well as with SFRCA on the expansion of transit services to our county. The second one is a lot of our peer agencies are very aggressively promoting opportunities to get involved in the decision making of their respective agencies. We are somewhat understaffed when it comes to public engagement, and so we're asking for an additional support person, a public relations specialist, who would allow us to grow our outreach efforts and increase our public engagement in the transportation decisions that you make as a community. So that's my summary of the budget request. Otherwise, it's pretty much routine from what we've done in your time.
Questions of Nick on the proposed budget? Yes, Mr. Berger.
In your budget, what is the breakdown on how you're funding your budget?
I have a better slide. Well, I'm trying to think. I'm not sure that we put that slide in the presentation on the UPWP. The short answer is we are front funded right now with county dollars, and then we reimburse the county with our grant funds that come from our federal highway and federal transit planning grant for about 95% of every dollar that we spend. So 5% is derived locally. Palm Beach County provides that money to us today as a match for our FTA grant, and we don't get it back. We don't give it back to them. They give it to the agency as a contribution. The other 95 cents of every dollar that they loan us, we give them back when we get reimbursed from our grant.
So your proposals for additional personnel, et cetera, are funded?
Grant funded.
Within
the grant revenue resources available to the agency. Yeah.
Okay, that was my question. I assume we have the revenues to support the additional positions as well as the additional line items.
Yeah.
Okay. And McKinley.
I just want to follow up on that issue. We have a commitment from those grant resources that there will be additional dollars to pay for those additional key positions.
So So,
or are we just hoping that we have those additional dollars?
The grant resources that we rely upon to do transportation planning are formula funds given to this agency to expend for transportation planning staff costs, consultants, and direct expenses, building expenses and whatnot. We have historically spent less than we've gotten, and the dollars that are available to us roll over. So not only do we have additional capacity to support these positions from our annual allocations based on those formulas, but we have, especially for the one-time expenses associated with moving, we have a carry-forward balance from unspent dollars from prior years that's available to us to accomplish that move. So short answer is yes. The grant revenues given to us by formula, this is not something we have to ask for and compete against other entities to receive, but are given to us because of our population, are reliable going forward and will accommodate these requests.
I don't mind supporting you putting this proposal forward today, but we just had a lengthy conversation at our commission meeting this week about wanting to see additional position requests and how they fit into the overall picture of the county budget. So my support today is no guarantee that I support it in the final budget vote that the county puts.
Once you are completely independent from the county, will this type of funding remain the way it is currently today, or will it change?
So one of the key things that will change as we transition to an independent agency is we will be asking at least two of our member entities to provide that loan to us so we can maintain our cash flow instead of just relying on Palm Beach County as the only source of temporary funding to spend and then reimburse. What that means is we'll be going to cities or the county and asking, would you be willing to loan us money on a temporary basis so that we can pay our bills, pay our staff, and then we'll give you the money back when we get our reimbursement check from the federal government. That change will mean we are no longer operating under the existing staff services agreement with Palm Beach County, so we won't have to submit a budget request to the county commission for approval. So while, you know, Mayor McKinley's comment is noted, one of the points of the transition is that we want this agency as a governing board to be the final decision maker on what to do with the dollars available to it. And her comment illustrates that that the opportunity exists for the county commission sitting separate from this board to say no to an action taken by this board and then prevent that action from being implemented.
But only on certain aspects of our programming. In other words, these positions are at our discretion, payable through the federal formula grant. Now, moving expenses probably was not. So that's something that, yes, the county or, you know, going forward, the municipal entities could say no to it. But the positions, though, are within the county would have no influence on your creating these positions because they're being created out of the federal funds. Am I right or not? Mm-hmm.
So
I can answer
I'm going to say, I'm looking to the back of the room because we did just transition legal representation, and the question is really a question of the finer points of the staff services agreement. And I know Donna was one of the authors of that agreement, but is no longer providing legal counsel to the TPA as a board. So I'm going to do my best to wing it because I haven't asked Paul to read the whole thing and give you a very thorough answer. My recollection is that if this board says this is how we want to use our grant funds and what we want to spend the dollars to accomplish, that the county commission, if they're going to be fully reimbursed for those expenditures, should not be able to say no to those expenses. But I'm going to say should, because I'm not certain.
But the board, the county commission wouldn't be able to use it for anything else. I mean, you're getting this formula grant from the federal government. And maybe we could veto how you spend it, but we couldn't or couldn't extract the funds and
spend it on our own transportation.
The leverage the county has is that we're spending your money first. And so you can imply your policies to our expenditure and use of those dollars,
right,
even
right.
though you're getting them back.
Right.
And that's part of our question, is how much should a pass-through entity be able to influence the use of dollars that they will ultimately recover?
Okay, but that's a small portion. Most of your funding is the federal government.
No, every dollar we spend is a county dollar first. We give 95 cents back to you.
Right, then we get
But you apply, right now the county applies county policies to every cent we spend. Even though they get 95 cents on the dollar back, they apply county policies to all of us. So you know, the question of whether they are in a position to say no to an action by this board is a question that we'll have to sort of flesh out in the detail.
Welcome, Donna.
Hi, thank you. Technically, this body is an independent body from the county. You make your own decisions. So your decisions are your decisions, but to the extent that the county has to appropriate funds, that is a Board of County Commission decision. So that's sort of where the crux of the problem is here. The employees that are work for the EPO are also all county employees, and included in the county's complement of employees. So the creation of new positions within the county's complement has to be approved by the board. Next statement to you, the county advances funds, and then the NPO reimburses them. And the county also provides some funds that are used as a match, which Nick explained earlier, which are not reimbursed to the county. So ultimately, the county does have the authority to appropriate, to make decisions on the employees, the number of employees that it provides to the NPO. And that's its authority. The NPO, the interlocal agreement contemplates that if the NPO wants to hire employees that are not within the county's complement, then there are provisions for doing so and some consequences that may flow from that if the county could so desire. We didn't actually talk about this issue when we were talking about the recent amendments to the staff interlocal agreement, but you know, depending upon what you all would want, that's something you can go and look at as well.
Thank you, Don. We appreciate that clarification. Mayor Gurley.
Going back to your adding a planner for transportation alternatives east-west, and you mentioned the Okeechobee corridor, would that not include Southern Boulevard corridor or Northlake Boulevard corridor?
Sure. What I was trying to do is say we need someone who can focus on investing in transit service improvement. And I gave a few corridors as examples, but it doesn't preclude focusing on any other places in Palm Beach.
Yeah.
My concern was that if we were just going to focus on one, that wouldn't be, you know, a good service. So.
Sure.
Thank you.
Clarification. Any further comments or discussions on the building? Seeing none, I'll entertain a motion. Motion by Pinto, second by Abrams, to adopt the Palm Beach TPA fiscal year 19 budget to be transmitted to the Palm Beach County. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor state so by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed. Excellent. We'll now move to our information items, and our first item is Complete Streets. Nick.
Madam Chair, we had a fantastic workshop yesterday, which was attended by several members of this governing board, as well as one of our alternate members who's in the audience this morning. And I'm going to introduce Emiko Atherton from Smart Growth America and the National Complete Streets Coalition to summarize a little bit of what we heard yesterday and some takeaways and action points for the governing board.
Welcome.
Thank you, Nick, and thank you, Chair Haney. It is a pleasure to be here today and see some familiar faces from yesterday. As Nick mentioned, I am the director of the National Complete Streets Coalition, which is a program of Smart Growth America. I'm based out of Washington, D.C., but I've spent a good part of my time in this role in the state of Florida working on Complete Streets. But this is my first time here, so it's such a pleasure. I should also mention this is, being in this room feels more like home. Before I came to the Complete Streets Coalition, I actually spent many years as the chief of staff for the chair of the Puget Sound Regional Council's MPO and staffed her through some long-range transportation plans. So I feel in a way more at home in this room than sometimes I do in Washington, D.C. So thank you for having me. I just wanted to give a little bit of a background on who the Complete Streets Coalition is and how kind of we arrived here today. The Complete Streets Coalition was founded as a separate nonprofit back in 2004. It really began as a conversation between different advocacy organizations throughout the county about not just how you create kind of more bicycle facilities or sidewalks, but how you actually transform the transportation planning process, which is really what all of you do, to start to consider all users of the system. And by all users, you can see a lot of those users represented there in what is now our steering committee, because we were a separate nonprofit originally. We had a board of directors. When we merged with Smart Growth America, we retained that leadership, but they're now known as the steering committee. And the organizations represented on that include founding members like AARP, who serves one of the primary leadership roles, groups like the American Public Transportation Association, which represents public transit agencies in the country, and they serve as kind of the primary leadership role and hold the chair seat. We also have groups like the American Heart Association, the National Association of Realtors, the Society for Landscape Architects, the Institute for Transportation Engineers, and you'll also see groups like the Washington State Department of Transportation, and the City of Orlando is actually a member of our steering committee. They joined last year. So these are really the groups that form the leadership and the strategic direction that I take. So really when I'm talking about the coalition, I'm talking about all of these groups. One of the things that we did is really create the concept of Complete Streets policies, which I'll get into more detail, but I just wanted to share the snapshot from our website. We, at the end of 2017, we had 1,348 Complete Streets policies in the country, represented in all 50 states and all levels of government, and actually about three quarters of those are in suburbs, mid-sized cities, small towns and rural areas. So it's really something that you can see, I think, it's quite embraced around here. There are around, I want to say, 70 policies in the state of Florida. You have one within your own jurisdictional boundaries in Delray that's award-winning. I know that the Palm Beach TPA adopted a Complete Streets policy last year, and that, you know, one of the things that I hope after this is that some of you will consider bringing Complete Streets policies to your communities. But what I wanted to talk about is really what are the benefits to having, you know, these Complete Streets. And I should talk actually before, when I mention Complete Streets, I'm not just talking about kind of one main street or one corridor that supports bicycles, pedestrians, transit, freight and vehicle users, but really we see Complete Streets as an approach to planning that considers all users of the roadway system, of all abilities, every time you think about transportation. It doesn't mean that you wind up with every street being multimodal, but that regardless of who I am or who I want to travel, I can get from my origin to my destination, which might be my work, my place of worship, it might be a medical appointment, it could be a social engagement, it could be access to healthy food, in a safe, reliable, affordable, convenient way within a reasonable amount of travel time. And so I was thinking, you know, regardless of how I wanted to travel, would I consider all of these to get to a job interview? Probably minus the biking, because I'd be sweaty and couldn't wear a suit. But, you know, is it that reliable? Is it affordable? Is it comfortable? Would I, you know, if it was something really important, would I trust, you know, whatever mode to get me there on time? And really, this has tremendous benefits, and I'll just touch on some of the most important ones. We talk a lot about safety, and I talk a lot about safety here in Florida because of this report that the National Complete Streets Coalition has published for well over a decade called Dangerous by Design. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that report here. It is a report that really we look at what pedestrian, you know, kind of the places in the country where you are most likely to be struck and killed by car. If you're walking, what makes this report different than total numbers is if you were to look at total numbers, you'd see cities like New York. There are 6 million people that live in New York, And so the number of people being struck and killed every day is larger than, you know, a community like West Palm Beach. However, your relative risk to being struck and killed it's different. So, you know, more people might be struck and killed every day in New York, but my relative risk of stepping out on the street and being struck and killed is higher in different places than it is in other. When we developed something called the Pedestrian Danger Index, which I can talk about the methodology offline, but what we've learned, and unfortunately one of the reasons why I have spent so much time in Florida, is that if you look at this, we rank the most dangerous states, and for well over a decade, Florida has been the most dangerous place to walk. You can see right there, the most dangerous places are on the Sun Belt, from Arizona to Florida and then up into Delaware. But these are the places with the highest pedestrian danger index score. And then when you look at the top 11 metropolitan statistical areas, you'll see that all but two of those are within the state of Florida. And the Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach MSA is number 11. So you are not in the top 10, but you are close. With that said, it's unfortunate, but I will give a ton of credit to the decision makers, really the leaders here in Florida, for being committed to changing that. I mean, that is why I am kind of, it's unfortunate that I've been here a lot for work. It's also, I feel very lucky that everyone I've met with, all of you, really, the leaders in the state, have been committed to turning this ship around. And so it's always a pleasure to come here and work on this. One of the things you can also find from this report is just to look at where these pedestrian fatalities are happening. So I pulled up, I just typed in Palm Beach, and you can see each instance, you can get demographic details. But what's even more interesting is when you start to look at a heat map, and you can see kind of where those are happening. Because we really, the part is called Dangerous by Design, because we're interested in kind of where are the spots that are designed to be unsafe. And you know this map better than I do, and why those red areas might be happening. But you can type in kind of any address in the United States and look this up. And I heard yesterday when we were doing the workshop, kind of people were like, oh yeah, that makes sense why that is there. And I'm sure probably all of you know better than I do. And then, so why we talk about design is there's actually a lot of interventions, kind of what we call in transportation language is proven engineering safety countermeasures that are approved by FHWA. And these are some of them, kind of, you can make the roadway so much safer just by design. So, you know, 88% of pedestrian crashes go down just by adding sidewalks. You can do things like hybrid beacons, medians, street conversions, which are road reconfigurations. So really, part of doing complete streets is actually changing the roadway design to support safety for all users. One of the things that we did is, so Florida, the state as a whole, has been number one. In 2011, before my time, the Secretary of Transportation for Florida called up our office, called up my predecessor, and said, we need your help getting out of this report. And so we spent over 2 years working with the district offices and headquarters on really how they could change what we call the DNA of FDOT to better support complete streets. And we ended up coming with this, we ended up authoring the Complete Streets Implementation Plan, which is the foundation for FDOT's Complete Streets program. And really the difference between this is you're not going to see in the report like build more bike lanes or build more sidewalks. You're going to see, look at your design guidelines to see if that's actually supporting better designs. Are you educating all of the employees within FDOT to understand why you want to do this and better ways to do this? Are you making sure that your funding decisions are aligned with complete streets? One of, I think, the most interesting findings from this report is that, so talking about design guidelines, which are like the reference, I always think of it as like almost a recipe book for how you build roadways, but it's the adopted kind of, you have the Florida Green Book here. And what in these, you know, focus groups they were hearing from the engineers is that, you know, we're being told to build kind of different multimodal streets, but there's nothing really in the Florida Green Book. There are only a few options for us. So every time we want to deviate from the recipe, we have to ask permission to do so. It's called a design exception. And that would put their projects behind schedule. And so when then it came time for their annual review, one of the things an engineer is reviewed on is being on time and on budget, and their projects were always behind schedule. So essentially they were penalized for building safer, better projects. So that's one of the benefits of complete streets. Another one that we're seeing across the country is really the economic benefits. We put out this report a few years ago called Safer Streets, Stronger Economies, where we really looked at the return on investment within 37 complete streets projects across the country. We looked at kind of controlled corridors versus citywide trends, and we also looked at pedestrian cost savings from averted collisions. One of the things that we learned kind of using a USDOT model was just within these 37 projects, which only represented around 50 to 60 miles of roadway, within 1 year averted $18.1 million in collision costs, which is huge. And those are costs that families bear, those are costs that employers bear, that insurance companies bear. They also encourage multimodal travel in almost all of the projects. And then depending on the goal of the project, automobile traffic either increased or decreased. Some of the goals had the project to decrease traffic and encourage more multimodal travel. And some of the projects actually wanted to increase throughput by all modes. They were also remarkably affordable. This is one of the things that we talk a lot about. You can find this report online because I realize that's hard to read. But nearly 75% of the projects cost less than the average normal cost arterial. Another way to think about this is we have another program at Smart Growth America called Practical Solutions. And it's the idea that we often kind of go with a transportation problem with the solution before we really identify the problem. So we think, well, you know, we need to fix an interchange, we'll just rebuild a giant interchange. And when you actually start to figure out what problem you're trying to solve, you end up often building kind of cheaper solutions that serve more modes, because you go through the process of scoping the problem, where we tend to, you know, engineers are problem solvers, so we tend to go with solutions. And so, you know, it's really when you start to dig into that, you actually deliver cheaper projects. And this has been a concept we've noticed in some of our federal work has resonated across states, across party lines, because it's about kind of building smarter, more cost-effective projects. They also really supported local economies. Most of the projects showed higher employment and property values, outpacing similar unimproved corridors and citywide trends. You saw net new businesses, higher retail sales, and private investments go up. I don't know how many of you are familiar with probably one of the most well-known case studies on kind of the economic and livability benefits to a road diet or a road reconfiguration is actually in Orlando. It's called Edgewater Drive. Has anyone heard of that? Yeah, and it was a project actually now like 15 years ago, and it was a state-owned road that was scheduled for repaving. And the city wanted to do what's called a road diet. They wanted to reconfigure the lanes, a four-lane road, into three lanes with two lanes, with a center turning line, and add bike lanes along the side. And what they discovered, even still today, is that not only was traffic not diverted to the side streets, and not only is traffic actually, they've been able to put in the same number of cars, and delay really hasn't changed at all, but the economic benefits, not just on the corridor, but within a quarter mile and a half mile, have been huge in terms of property values, new businesses. Someone in the workshop today was saying she lived right off of Edgewater Drive, and every time she goes back, there's like new businesses just spurring and spurring. And it used to just look like, you know, one of many arterials that you see across the country. So we're really seeing the huge economic benefits. Here's another fact we pulled up. This is another way of looking at what we're spending on crashes. And it's, you know, it's a number that I think we can't even start to wrap our heads around. But talking about kind of, you know, what happened on Edgewater Drive and what's happening across, I think, you know, we hear these trends is really this idea of livability. We put out a report card, Core Values, with which we interviewed 100 CEOs. We did this in partnership with Cushman Wakefield to see why they're kind of locating where they are. And it was that, you know, we all hear this talk of like the millennial, I feel like they're like a new species, but that, you know, they move to a place and then they get a job. And I think two people on my team who are considered generationally millennials moved to DC without jobs because they wanted to be there. DC is a very walkable, bikeable city. And then they got a job, which I would have never done when I graduated back in 2000. I knew that I had to go to where jobs were, not the other way around. But so we hear this anecdotally, but these CEOs confirmed this. It's really people want to live in walkable, bikeable places, but not just cities, but, you know, small towns, rural areas, and that they are choosing to move downtown because that's the only way that they can attract and retain talent. About 3 weeks ago, I was in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and I don't know if any of you know, like, what's home to Bentonville, Arkansas, but it is Walmart. And I had never been to Arkansas, and Bentonville and Fayetteville are like hipper than Washington, D.C. I mean, they are so cool, and I was shocked, but it's because the Walton Family Foundation and some of Tyson's is there figured out the only way they were going to get people to move to Northwest Arkansas was to make some of the places want to live. They're trying to make themselves the premier mountain biking destination in the country. They're interested in making it a huge arts hub. There are bike lanes everywhere. There are breweries everywhere. And I saw more people, you know, more millennials than I do in my own neighborhood in Washington, D.C. But they got that was key to their survival. And so we say this, you know, when it comes to complete streets, one of the great things is when you start to build transportation networks, for all users, you really think about those who are 8 and those who are 80, and those really resonate for everyone. One of the interesting things is that, you know, we talk a lot about millennials, but I mentioned AARP actually serves and was one of the primary leaders. Often what millennials want, what older adults want, is the same thing. I'm sure we've all heard this term, like aging in place. People don't want to necessarily move to, both my grandparents live in a retirement home, and, you know, somewhere that was very kind of isolated. We have to drive to them, they can't drive anymore. And as my mom gets older, my mom is retired and she lives in a, you know, somewhat walkable neighborhood. It could be better, but she's losing her vision and she doesn't want to move. She still wants to be independent. She has to be able to walk to transit, to walk to the grocery store. And we're seeing that more and more with trends. The realtors also published reports that people, regardless of where they are in their country, want more mobility choices. They want to remain independent. I think it's now like, you know, 50 is the new 20. But truly we are, you know, we want to be closer to people. We want more independence. And that's what I think we're going to see across the country. And cities are, one of my colleagues says, you know, places are, you know, cities right now are in a really fierce competition for a sense of place. And that, you know, I think the places that are going to rise up are going to be the places that get that. You know, one of the things that was really interesting to watch was the Amazon, which is the new H2 headquarters. This is actually a photo, you can't see it very well, but it's from Birmingham, Alabama, two of my colleagues there a few months ago during the proposal process. Birmingham, which has done a ton to revitalize their downtown, actually had this big kind of fake Amazon package. But it showed that, Amazon was looking for somewhere with a really good transit system. That was a key requirement. And so, you know, that's where businesses want to locate. The other thing about this, and I put it in a slide, but chronic disease continues to be a growing problem in the United States. The CDC came out with a report last year that 4 in 10 Americans are obese, 7 in 10 are overweight, about a third of our kids are obese. So we're setting up the next generation to be, to suffer problems, to suffer heart disease, diabetes, sleep apnea. And one of the best and most cost-effective ways to address this is actually active transportation. The CDC recognizes, and they're very evidence-based, and they recognize complete streets is one of the proven evidence-based strategies to improve chronic disease. And so that's another benefit. So getting on to kind of what complete streets policies are, is that they really are starting to institutionalize that the entire right-of-way is planned, designed, constructed, operated, and maintained to provide safe access for all users. This does not, again, mean that you're putting a bike lane on every street, but that each time you're touching the transportation system, you're thinking about, could I make this better for all users? Do I need to? Is there a parallel road? How is this fitting into a larger network? I love what Mayor McKinley, did I say that right? What you mentioned about the, you know, when you're out there digging up a road, could you think about restriping a bike lane? I mean, that to me is complete streets. It's not just those big multi-million dollar projects. So those are great. You know, when you have a complete streets policy, you're institutionalized that every time you go out there, you're doing a repaving project, a restriping project, you're tearing up a curb. How could we make this better incrementally for all users? So really what it means is making the needs of all users the default. Right now we've kind of been, you know, those of us that have worked in transportation for a while, we came up in a world where the default was to plan for the automobile, not for people. And this is not by any means, like this is a very pro kind of all modes and that includes cars, but that you think of cars and transit and people in wheels, whether that's a wheelchair on bikes and people on their feet and people, I don't know, skateboards. I had a dream the other night I was rollerblading. I don't know what that says. And that, you know, so you're really shifting transportation investments so they create better streets opportunistically. That is, every time you're doing something small, like tearing up, you know, you have a public works project that you're working on, you can make the street better each time you touch it, not just in those big capital planning. It is so much cheaper and effective over time. To save money, when you have to go back and retrofit, it is much more expensive. And I think, you know, we'll learn a kind of in hindsight as we talk about these trends and preferences that, you know, if you don't put in those features now, people are going to want them and it's way more expensive to go back and do that. And then it's starting to give, you know, really transportation professionals the political and community support, I think, to go out there when they're working with the public, but also other jurisdictions. One of the things that came up yesterday in the workshop, and I've seen come up in other places, is that often you, being local governments, representing local governments, will want to do something to one of your roadway, or do something in your community, but on a roadway you don't own. It might be owned by the state. Does this sound familiar? And the state will be like, no. And one of the things that a lot of cities have found has been powerful is saying, we've adopted a complete streets policy. Like, you know, in Florida, Florida has a complete streets policy. We have a complete streets policy. Like, we have made a commitment, you know, a legislative commitment or an executive commitment to complete streets. And what you're doing, you know, is counter to what we, our vision and what we've expressed as a city. And we've seen that work a lot in the state of Tennessee, who also has a multimodal access policy. But I think it would be a very powerful tool from the state of Florida to start to get at some inequity. So one of the things I didn't talk about in Dangerous by Design is that really we're seeing the people who are most impacted and most likely to be struck and killed are actually older adults and people of color. We also are realizing that transportation choices and transportation infrastructure is often in higher income communities and that lower income communities face some of the biggest transportation challenges. The Federal Reserve Bank has said that transportation challenges like car ownership, expensive car ownership, not access to public transportation, not being able to walk to public transportation is one of the larger barriers to employment. Because if you can't get to work, you can't have, you know, on time, you're not going to be able to keep a job, much less get one. And then to start to look to come together on a shared vision that leverages more funding opportunities. On Friday, the federal Tiger grants came out. Looks like many of you are probably familiar, but those are federal grants for transportation projects that stimulate jobs and they actually go straight to locals. They don't go through the state, they don't go through the TPA, they can go straight to your city. And that one of the things that scored really well when you looked at those were complete streets projects, scored so well. This is from last year's round of grants, but the city of Mobile, Alabama got $14.5 million to do a complete streets corridor project within their city. But they had a complete streets policy and they've really done a lot of work on that. And they were able to leverage that into making a project happen that never would have otherwise. And then to eventually gradually complete a network that serves all users of all abilities. So yesterday we had this fabulous workshop, which I see many of you were at. What we heard from it is that some of the biggest challenges are, again, balancing local needs versus state needs. How to coordinate all against, you know, with all of your jurisdictions. We know that, you know, how many jurisdictions did you all drive through on your way here? And that, you know, as a user, you don't know where one jurisdiction ends and one doesn't. Oh, do we have a question? Oh, a lot. How do we pay for all this? Where to start? How you connect land use and transportation? So, you know, we just can't fix curb to curb, but really one of the bigger challenges, I think, across the country, but particularly in that southeast belt where you saw a lot of the pedestrian fatalities, is that you're struggling with the newer, more suburban land use patterns that aren't necessarily conducive to encouraging, I would say, you know, bike and bicycle travel or foot traffic. We drove on one street, I can't remember what it was, but we all commented that there was a bike lane stripe on it. It's kind of that direction. Someone might know what I'm talking about. But we were driving about 60 miles an hour, and there was, you know, maybe a 4-foot bike lane stripe. And that alone is not going to, you have to kind of fix what's around as well as what's in the roadway. That there needs to be kind of, you know, really robust community engagement, talking to people about kind of what they want, what they need, knowing who the gatekeepers are, and really that's, you know, how to connect with all of each other to get things done. Who should be leading? That was a big question. Should it be the state? Should it be the cities? Who should take the first step? There was a lot of desire to have the county with their new kind of, you know, their new guidance on these bike lanes, maybe the county taking a big step forward. How you deal with conflicting guidance, and that actually has to go into that thing I was mentioning, the Green Book, and what cities want to do with their roads and what's allowed by the state. How to develop a vision and then maintain public support. So I just wanted to end with some recommendations. That I was joined yesterday by two of my colleagues who are also on the National Complete Streets Steering Committee. And kind of what are some first steps that you all as the TPA could take? And one is looking at all of you really adopting Complete Streets policies within your cities and having the county do so as well. Starting to, as the TPA and maybe TPA staff start to educate cities on upcoming, or let them know about upcoming resurfacing and surfacing projects. So that means, you know, once something's going out there that the state is doing, how can you proactively take action in that? And then in the issue of funding, you know, would you consider endorsing a clear recommended alternative to the current road impact fee system, moving to more of a mobility fee versus a road impact fee? And with that, I wanted to thank all of you. I think there's probably more politics behind them than I'll ever know. But thank you all. And if you have, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Any questions? What a great presentation. Thanks so much for your leadership on this. And we're working through that last question. And we'll get there. So
great.
We really appreciate it.
Great. Well, thank you. And I just want to offer myself, should you have, need any support on Complete Streets policies, as well as your fabulous TPA staff.
Thank you, Commissioner Burke.
I do. Would you send us along some additional information that we could look at about the disparity that you've seen in neighborhoods?
Yes, absolutely. I will make sure to get that to Nick and Valerie, who can pass that on to you. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the phrase, your zip code determines your life expectancy. When I was at working in King County, Washington, I actually worked with the public health department that did some of the first research figuring out kind of where you live determined your life outcomes, like, you know, your obesity, your asthma rates, your diabetes rates, and it had to do with like what you have access to. Do you have access to healthy food? Can you walk outside? Can you take transit? And I used to live by the University of Washington. It was also right by the, probably a half a mile between the on-ramp to the highway that would take you to Microsoft. And my neighbors, my community had health outcomes of Scandinavia, like countries in Scandinavia. And where I was spending some work at the time was around the airport. It's I'd say it's probably 75% people of color, mostly low income, a lot of first generation immigrants, and they had terrible noise pollution, no transit service, no sidewalks, no healthy food, and they had health outcomes of developing countries in Africa. And you could get between the two in 15 minutes in your car. I mean, and this is in the Seattle region, which is beautiful, known for all of this, and we had these pockets of just extreme poverty and poor health.
I represent the western side of this county, which is predominantly rural. And so I would love some examples of some of the best complete street projects we've seen in very rural or agricultural areas, if you can get that to us.
I would love to. That's actually, we've seen, I think about 15% of complete streets policies are in rural communities, and I've spent a lot of time working on that, so I would love to send that on to you.
Well, thank you so much, and we appreciate the presentation and your partnership and your leadership on this.
Thank you all.
Great. We will now move to something real exciting, our UPWP.
Madam Chair, I'm actually going to do this presentation. Can one of you guys talk to me about the remote? So just as background, as they're running up with that, the UPWP, or Unified Planning Work Program, is our agency's budget, and it is our business plan. It's what we have to accomplish, or what we are asking for dollars to accomplish. And specifically, it answers three key questions. What are you going to produce? Who's going to do the work? Is it staff or consultants? And when are you going to get it done? Those three things, we say, okay, this is what we want to accomplish over the next 2 years. We're going to use a combination of our staff and our consultant services support contract, and we're going to finish these projects over the next 2 years. It's a funding request of our federal funding partners, so Federal Highway, Federal Transit. Our document is divided into seven core tasks. Task number one is engage the public. The key here is we are investing transportation resources that are paid by the general public. The dollars available to us are gas tax revenues, and we want to make sure that we're investing them in ways that our community supports. So engage the public. Some of the highlighted tasks for this one are our public outreach activities, our website and social media activities, as well as the monitoring of the performance measures in our public participation plan. Task number two, planning the system, is our update to our long-range transportation plan. What do we want to accomplish in the next 10 years, and then in the next 15 years after that? It looks out over a 25-year horizon, with an emphasis, especially on the update that we're doing right now, on what we hope to accomplish in the next 10 years. So we make sure we're funding projects that will go into implementation over that next 5 to 10 year period, so that we can realize some of the goals and outcomes that we're looking for. Again, from last meeting, there was an adoption of zero as a target for fiscal, for 20-year calendar year 2018, zero as a target for fatalities and serious injuries and pedestrian and bicycle fatalities and serious injuries. One of the asks that this board made of me was to present you with a Vision Zero action plan, so that we don't just say it's a great idea to have that as a target, but we actually come up with things to do, things this agency can do to move the needle closer to that target of zero. Our modal network planning tasks, how do we fill gaps in our sidewalk layer? How do we fill gaps in our bicycle facilities network? How do we provide improved transit service? All goes into the planning of the system. And then any specific corridor studies that we would take on. The US 1 corridor, we're wrapping up right now, the recommended outcomes for that corridor, and the Okeechobee Boulevard study we're going to be kicking off in the next few months, and then we've certainly talked quite a bit about State Road 80 and the recommended outcomes for that corridor that the DOT is moving the study on. So all that goes under planning the system. I want to make this point clear, especially for our municipal partners. We have a contract with the Treasure Coast as a regional planning consultant. They are a public agency that operates as an effective planning consultant partner. And what we do with this contract is we have a local planning partnership relationship with Treasure Coast, where we say to any of our cities, if you would like us to help you fund a planning project on a local facility or a local area that doesn't cover more than just your jurisdiction, come talk to me and we'll find a way to fund half of that study, that work that leads to a recommended outcome, up to about $50,000. So we have a contract with Treasure Coast that gives us $150,000 a year to allocate to projects like this. And we use these dollars to make the planning funds available to our local partners, because maybe they don't have the planning expertise or the resources to do this kind of planning work. And this has been a very effective component of planning the system for us in Palm Beach County. Task three is prioritizing the funding. Where are we going to spend the money for the things that we plan? This is our annual adoption of our priority project list, focusing on our major projects, our local initiatives, our transportation alternatives, and then new this year, when we present this priority project list to you, we're also going to present suggested projects to improve the safety of our system that can be funded with federal safety dollars. So we're going to add that as a fourth component to our annual priority project list this year. And then, if you're familiar with, each year we are obligated to adopt our transportation improvement program, which says we're going to use these dollars from various programs to accomplish these projects in the next 5 years and a particular schedule for each one of those projects. So that's the prioritizing the funding. And then on implementing projects, we don't actually get to build anything. Sometimes I wish we did, but we don't get to build projects. We don't get to operate projects, but we do get to walk alongside the entities that we are funding, providing dollars to fund projects, to ensure that the projects are implemented consistent with this board's plan and direction. So we want to make sure that we're focusing on those projects that get built, making sure they are the best possible version of themselves, they do the most good for our transportation system, and then also monitoring our performance measures, the federally required performance measures like safety, like health of our bridges, like health of our pavement, as well as the things that we've chosen to monitor locally, like percentage mode split on our journey to work data, so that we want to see our commuters not just traveling by automobile alone, but also beginning to travel more and more by transit service, by foot, or by bicycle. So we're monitoring the objectives in our long-range plan in that task. Collaboration with partners, Mayor Haney referenced the CEFTEC activity. That's our formal partnership with the Broward MPO and the Miami-Dade PPO for planning across the jurisdictional, across the county boundaries in Southeast Florida. Any other partner agencies participating in Safe Routes to School activities, community safety, transportation team meetings with the DOT, any ad hoc working groups that we would conduct to evaluate things like the mobility fee, things like the complete streets policy and then design guidelines, those activities would fall under this umbrella task. And then any training events that we would conduct, like the complete streets workshop that we provided yesterday, and like the MPOAC workshop that we're going to be providing in May to allow all of you to have a chance instead. For those of you who are unable to go to the MPOAC Institute, which is that weekend-long opportunity to learn a little bit more about what an MPO board member is able to do and how your role and function plays out, we're actually going to bring those trainers here for an afternoon in Palm Beach County and provide you with a condensed version of that so that you can fit it into your busy schedule. So all of those activities fall under collaborating partners. And then last, number six rather, is administering the agency. That's making sure that we're implementing the tasks in the strategic plan that you told me to accomplish. We're updating and monitoring our budget. We're doing facilitation of our meetings, publishing agendas, refreshments, and what have you, and coordination on minutes, any financial tasks, and then the independent agency transition activities could all fall under administration as well. Getting to the last one, this was a question that Commissioner James brought up last month. What would you do with those member dues that you're now asking us to pay? So we actually thought it would be a good idea to show you, and I want to make this point clear. This is a draft. This is a proposal. This is not, we're not asking for action today, but to show you what would you use those $130,000 of member dues that you would collect if we were to go with the 10 cent per capita approach to member dues. Well, number one, expenditure is advocacy. We would be able to establish priorities of this board and then actually travel to Washington, travel to Tallahassee, and pay consultant support to ensure that the policies of this board are being given due consideration and acted upon, whether we're trying to change legislature, whether we're trying to change decisions of agency partners, or whether we're trying to persuade discretionary decisions to go our way for projects that we want to fund with those discretionary funding dollars. We would also be able to fund our promotional items and activities, like the Bike to Work ride, like the Safe Street Summit, some of the outreach activities, some of the promotional items that we distribute at those events are not reimbursable under our federal grants. Any other non-reimbursable expenses in this category really covers things like coffee and donuts at our meeting, and things like member dues at our professional society. So our staff, most of us are members of the AICP certified and members of the American Planning Association. I'm an outlier. I'm an engineer, so I'm a member of the Institute of Transportation Engineers and folks in American Society of Civil Engineers. But those membership dues are not payable or not reimbursable under our grant. I do want to make one point as we talk about the transition process. Commissioner Abrams mentioned that our moving expenses are not reimbursable under the grant. That's not true. We're actually able to fund all of those reimbursements, or all of those transition costs are reimbursable expenses. So we would be able to fund all of those. They wouldn't be paid out of the member dues. They would be paid from our grant resources. And then sponsorship support, if this agency wants to participate in order to promote visibility and the visibility of this entity, as well as support initiatives by some of our partners in promoting good transportation facilities in Palm Beach County, then the member dues would be able to be used for that. And then we're suggesting that the balance of whatever dues paid that in a given year would be going toward our reserve fund in order to build that reserve fund and reduce any dependence that we would have on those temporary funding relationships that we would be establishing with our local government partners to kind of help us manage our own cash flow. So I think that's the big picture summary. The ask of you is, as we're developing this draft, if there's any discussion this morning on additional items that you want us to consider, and I heard one already this morning, the consideration of some type of evaluation of a countywide bike share system that would be interoperable within our various communities. Maybe that's a path that we would add into this document. Any particular studies that you'd like us to take on, any additional work that you want us to do over the next couple of years. Your strategic plan gives you another opportunity. We do that in July, is the evaluation and then updating that. So it gives you another opportunity to provide us with that kind of direction and feedback. But this document is sort of the overall framework for funding. And I've got Renee's phone number as well as her email address here, because she is the lead on this project. She is developing the UPWP, and I'm just trying to give you the high level summary and be happy to hear any questions you have from me.
Any questions on the UPWP? Now, I said it before, but I think this regional bike share is important. If, you know, we want to, you know, not do it city by city, this is one thing that if we all partner together and chose one agency, that we could really have, you know, the regional solutions. Yes.
Are we having any conversation? I mean, we have waterways in this county as well that are, you know, definitely connect. Are we having any conversations about the use of water taxis and that mode of transportation?
That's a great question.
We actually funded, again, through that local planning partnership with Treasure Coast, we funded a big portion of the initial cost needed for the Blue Wave plan, and then for the water
taxis
from
North End.
What am I trying to say?
Yeah.
The C-51, the boat lift to connect the inland waterways with the intercoastal in order to provide more connected navigable waterways in Palm Beach County. That being said, we haven't done a great deal of analysis of how a water taxi service might alleviate demand on other modes or provide increased economic activity benefits.
I would love to leave my office and go to a meeting in Mayor Haney's office
on
the intercoastal.
It would be nice.
We have
looked at the water taxi.
The only one that seems to work is the one from Riviera Beach to Canada.
Yeah, that's more recreation than it is.
But
is Richard Rockclub still here?
Yeah,
Richard. Yeah, the league was involved in the water taxi analysis. city by city, having, yeah, come up and just share like that. I think it's important that we look at, we say we're multimodal, we need to look at every mode.
Yes, well, we put together and actually started at the, from this group, and they requested that we get together with the county, and we put together an ordinance, and all water taxis are now part of the system. They can opt out if they want to, but we put together an ordinance that was passed by the county commission so that it's very easy for them to get certified. They go through consumer affairs. They can be certified in all the cities. They just have to, it's a minor fee, and they also have to give their insurance. Mm-hmm. But it's ready to roll. I mean, it's ready there. The problem is the costs involved with running the service.
Yeah, and the ridership, Well, thank you for refreshing our memories on that. Commissioner Berger.
I don't, you know, with the work plan, I don't know, quite understand the total capacity of what we could do. But the young lady who was talking about the smart growth and complete streets talked about some of those areas in communities where there is disparate treatment. And if we were to get that information, we can see how it fits in, how we think people with the priorities that we don't sit down there.
I just wanted to bring up the discussion about bike sharing. We don't want to make the Sky Bike less viable and the things the cities are doing. So as we look at that, let's make sure that, you know, I think they're subsidized already. We don't want to make it more of an obligation for the cities that are already doing that.
Further comments? Okay, excellent.
Thank you.
We'll now move to our partner agency updates. Are there any of our partners present that want to address the board? Mr. Ricks, please come forward. Welcome to have you.
Good morning, Chair, Vice Chair, members of the board. Just want to piggyback on the Complete Streets discussion, and I was at the workshop yesterday, and in a former life, actually had us, she came to Norfolk when I was a public work director, so we as an organization, Norfolk, we went through that journey in terms of developing a plan, doing a bike plan, and also doing projects. But related to what our organization doing, the county engineer is doing, we have two major resurfacing projects that are in progress, Okeechobee Boulevard and also North Lake, and working with Nick in his office, we're putting together some bike lanes related to that resurfacing project. But as a practical matter, as we going forward with these resurfacing projects, our policy is that if the traffic to vehicle length was 11 feet, anything outside that, if there's space on that roadway, we'll start putting together a bike path, striping for that. And then in some of the areas in terms of the green paint, I wasn't here for that discussion, but Nick assisted us with getting the authorization of Federal Highway Administration to authorize that. So we'll be putting some of those in some of the conflict areas as needs warranted, but not the complete restriping. Because that's a pretty positive endeavor, and also from a major standpoint.
Excellent. Thank you.
Mr. Mayor. So I had a quick question. I know that the green paint is very intensive to maintain.
Yes.
What about the guy riding the bike in white? Is that as intensive, and is that something that we could do when they're not, you know, when it's not necessarily...
You can talk about Cheryl's?
Yeah.
Not the Cheryl's, but just basically it's a designated bike lane, but with no marker on that designated bike lane. Is it possible for the county to look into seeing, start putting, just, you know, notifying the bike people and the vehicles that it is a designated bike lane, and not necessarily paint the whole thing green, just having that little guy at the beginning of the intersection or major intersection?
Well, we can take a look at that.
All right, thank you.
Plastic, yeah.
Good point.
Well, thank you, Dave. We appreciate it.
All
right. Being our partner in this.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Anyone from PalmTran have anything to say? SFRTA? FDOT? Yeah? Everybody good? Yeah? Okay. Great. We appreciate you being here. We appreciate your partnership. I will now move February's Public Involvement Activity Report. It was provided for us. Our next meeting is April 19th in Green Acres. Thank you, Mayor, for hosting us. And is there any other comments? comments or discussions to come before the TPA? If not, yeah, don't leave till we take the picture. And we are adjourned at 10:41. Thank you all so much.